from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Michael Levy heads the program on energy security and climate change at the Council on Foreign Relations. He joins us to talk about his new book, The Power Surge, Energy, Opportunity, and the Battle for America's Future, which investigates the growing energy revolutions in the United States. Forum is next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Oil production over the past year has grown by the greatest amount since the beginning of the oil industry. Michael Levy points out in his new book, The Power Surge, Energy, Opportunity, and the Battle for America's Future. Natural gas production this past year hit an all-time high, and at the same time, renewable energy production has more than doubled over the last few years, and prices for renewable technologies have plummeted. What does all this mean? Well, for Michael Levy, who's a senior fellow for energy and the environment with the Council on Foreign Relations, it means rethinking our energy strategy. His work writing has appeared in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, Wired, Foreign Affairs, and the New Republic, and he joins us on this Forum Hour. Glad to have you here. Welcome.
Great to be here with you.
Well, where do we begin? We begin by talking, I suppose, about two energy revolutions, as you call them, with different, almost discernibly different and dramatically different ideological lines.
We've seen extraordinary change in American energy in the last 5 years, a period of greater change than in 30 or 40 years. We've had, as you said, oil production increased by the largest amount in American history in 1 year. Last year, natural gas passed coal as the top domestic source of U.S. energy. At the same time, renewable production has doubled and U.S. oil consumption peaked in 2005 and has headed pretty steadily down since then. And what you see is consequences for the economy, for security, the environment, but also a retrenchment into some old political and ideological battle lines, with one side really focused on boosting supplies of fossil fuels and the other side very much committed to alternatives and to efficiency and conservation. And both to a good extent agreeing that there is a drastic choice between the two paths right now.
And both, one would assume, are at such odds and so polarized that never the twain shall meet. But you say this is not a zero-sum game between, say, old sources of energy, as we could call them, fossil fuels and the like, and new green energy. There is a strategy for, well, bringing them together.
I argue in the book that we should be pursuing a most of the above way of thinking about energy. People often talk about all of the above, which is sounds like an indiscriminate way of pursuing absolutely everything at whatever cost. That doesn't make a lot of sense to me. But what I see is natural gas production allowing us to cut our emissions at the same time as renewable energy gives us an increasingly strong option for zero carbon energy. I see growing oil production creating economic benefits and making us a bit more secure, but at the same time, not making us genuinely energy independent, which is a place where cutting our oil consumption can really have a big impact. So each of the different sources and different trends has a different set of benefits, and we can take advantage of those when we pursue more than one thing at the same time.
Well, you say don't look at the downsides, look more at the up. But when you're talking about energy consumption and you're talking about the carbon print footprint, there are many who say, look, we're at the end of the line here as far as climate change is concerned and as far as what we're doing to the environment, it's save the planet time.
I should be very clear that I do think we should look at the downsides, but I don't think we should fixate only on the downsides. The downsides are part of why you pursue a most of the above approach rather than an all of the above approach, because you don't want excessive oil consumption, you don't want excessive carbon emissions, and you don't want intolerable dangers to the local environment. On climate change, I think you need to look at what's happening in natural gas and what's happening in oil separately. Right now, natural gas is mostly pushing aside coal. That's reducing U.S. emissions, along with lower consumption and penetration of renewables. And it's also reducing local pollution at the same time. over the longer haul, we're either going to need to deploy renewable energy, nuclear power, or capture and sequester the carbon dioxide that comes from our power plants. One way or the other, we're going to need to move to a zero-carbon electricity system. I think oil is more complicated. You can't tell a story where more oil production means lower greenhouse gas emissions, but you can look at how big the impact is. And the main consequence of higher U.S. oil production is that other countries, particularly in the Middle East, will cut back on their own production in order to not flood the market. They want prices to stay high. If you are making policy in Saudi Arabia, you don't want prices to crash because you need to pay your bills and keep your country stable. Because of that,
we're going to be ahead of Saudi Arabia in a few years, though, right? In terms of oil production.
It's quite possible that we'll be ahead of them, but part of that will be because we expect them to restrain themselves so that the net impact on total world oil production is a lot smaller than one might imagine. That means the net impact on global emissions is smaller than a lot of people would expect.
So let's translate this. I mean, in terms of government's role, government should create opportunities for the supply side. They should support technology regulations, but weed out excess. I mean, that's pretty much what you're saying, isn't it?
That's basically what I'm saying. Let me give you an example of why I think that despite the big changes we have in technology, we still need the right policy decisions to move forward. When I was writing the book, I visited a solar manufacturing facility outside of Pittsburgh. They're making enormous mirrors for utility-scale solar plants. They had started to build the factory in 2009 or so when they had a lot of hope for strong rules that would promote alternative energy. When I got there, the factory was roughly half built because those rules had fallen through. And when I looked at the pallets of these enormous heavy mirrors stacked up on the side and asked, where are these being shipped? They said, oh, well, these ones are being shipped to India. Why? Because India had adopted an aggressive national solar mission to promote the adoption of solar power. So ultimately, we get these technological changes, but we still need to make the right policy decisions to take full advantage of them.
How does shale gas figure into all this? I mean, I know to a great extent it's been exaggerated as a solution for our energy problems. We're going way back when I can remember talking about it, you know, looking for it in Colorado and everything. But there are many who feel it is a really good strategy for at least U.S. independence. But your feeling is, first of all, that it's not as dangerous to the air or the water as many citizens seem to be concerned.
Well, let's start with that environmental question. There are significant risks if you don't handle shale gas and tight oil development properly. You have to worry in particular about how you dispose of the wastewater, not as much what goes into the ground as what comes back out. You need to worry about air emissions, particularly when there's a lot of development in one area. An individual rig might not have that big an impact on the air, but the cumulative impact can be large. And you have to make sure that the communities integrate development well. When I was writing the book, I visited with Bill Dix, a dairy farmer in Southern Ohio, and he talked to me about two trips he'd taken. He'd taken a trip to Wetzel County, West Virginia, and he said he saw what had happened with development there, and he came back and he had nightmares. And then he said he visited Bradford County, Pennsylvania, and he said it wasn't perfect, but the rules were better, and the community had gotten organized and made sure they had leases that protected themselves, and it was night and day. And to me, that captured the difference between having the right rules and companies doing things the right way and having the wrong rules and having things not work out for anyone.
We're talking to Michael Levy, and his new book is The Power Surge, Energy, Opportunity, and the Battle for America's Future. And where does fracking fit into all this?
Well, this is what we're talking about. In Southern Ohio, fracking is the technique that's being used for development. And when Bill had gone to West Virginia and to Pennsylvania, that was fracking being applied. And that's what we're talking about in a lot of cases with oil and gas development here. It's the water impacts, the air impacts, and really missed by a lot of people, the community impacts of this.
Local impacts particularly, yeah.
I mean, if you had to design an experiment where you took a community and selected a random set of people in it to make extremely rich, and then you selected another set of people to make somewhat better off, and then you took a third set who couldn't work and they just saw prices rising, you would expect a lot of social tension. And what happens when people discover this enormous amount of oil and gas underground is exactly that. And so it's perfectly predictable that you'll have this tension. You have to make sure that development is done in a way first that protects people, but also that makes sure that some of the benefits are shared broadly.
Talking again with Michael Levy, the book is The Power Surge. And this actually, has been a steady trajectory to some extent, according to your reporting and the fine writing you've done in this book, 40 years. I mean, first oil crisis, also first Earth Day. I mean, you can almost map this in terms of where we have gone and where we've arrived at. And where we've arrived at is a place where, as you've suggested, the two sides are very polarized. You only have, what, about 5% of the American people who think that maybe there's some kind of synthesis between these two?
Certainly when you do polling, if you ask people, are you for fossil fuels or alternative energy, very few people offer up an alternative, a third way of looking at things. I think we've gone in cycles. In the aftermath of the 1973 oil crisis, we started by moving forward on multiple fronts. We had big pipeline across Alaska approved that led to a recovery in U.S. oil production. We had the first ever fuel economy rules for cars and trucks a couple years later. But if you fast forward 10 years into the future, you had plummeting oil production, less access to new lands, and a starving of clean energy for funds. And on top of that, a pass on new fuel economy rules. And we sort of coasted on energy for a long time. Over the last few years, we've gone back first to these big changes on the two sides, but then increasingly into the same fights that we had back then. In some ways, we really haven't stopped to rethink how energy fits into our modern world. We not only grasp for these old political fights, but for our old ways of thinking about how changes in American energy affect our security, affect our economy, affect our environment.
Well, I'm also thinking about the fact that even despite this extraordinary supply increase, and many of us remember the long gas lines during the Carter administration, global prices, no decline, price at the pump, still high. Now, I know refinery shutdowns figure into this whole equation, but nevertheless, from the average consumer's point of view, energy is still very expensive and it hasn't necessarily eased up.
And we shouldn't expect prices to be substantially and sustainably lower as a result of what's happening.
Although they're much better here than they are across the pond and in Europe. I mean,
but that's the difference in taxes and regulations,
right,
rather than the difference in production. One could argue that we should have higher priced gasoline in order to discourage consumption so that we reduce our vulnerability to volatile oil markets and to entanglements overseas and to climate change. But what's happening in American oil is mostly a rise in production here that displaces oil produced elsewhere. That doesn't end up pushing prices all that far down. The bottom line is that this new American oil is relatively expensive to produce, and it wouldn't be produced if oil prices were a lot lower than they are right now.
Todd Friedman was on with us yesterday. He's in favor of a carbon tax. A lot of talk about cap and trade, about, as you say, taxing gas, providing clean energy policies and standards that would need to be, on the face of it, really flexible. And so, I mean, the one thing you come away with from your book is the sense that none of this is really predictable and none of this has certainty to it. So when we're looking at policy, I think what you're suggesting here is just an even course, steady kind of policy that uses the best of both possible worlds.
And that's right. You said earlier that I argue for expanding opportunities, but then weeding out the bad investments. And that's what that sort of strategy should do. I think Tom Friedman is right that whether it's through a carbon tax or cap and trade or a clean energy standard, we need to create a level playing field where sources that pollute more pay the price for their pollution so that all of the different options can compete effectively. But we do need whatever approach we pursue to be flexible. I'm constantly amazed that the lesson a lot of people have taken from all these changes in the last few years is that we should take our confident but now wrong views of 5 years ago and replace them with equally confident views about the future based on what's happening today. To me, one of the big messages of what's happened is don't be too confident in your predictions of the future. Build your strategies, whether you're an individual or a business or a policymaker, to be resilient to surprise and to be able to take advantage of new opportunities.
Well, we talked about the economy in the last hour, and if one thing is as uncertain as energy, it's the economy in general. But how does this large oil and gas production bear on the economy? Does it really is it moving the needle much at all?
I think it is making a significant change to the overall economy. If we had had this happen in a normal economic time where we have what economists call full employment, most people who are looking for jobs are able to find them, then it wouldn't move the needle as much, particularly on job creation, because people who became employed in oil and gas would be leaving jobs somewhere else. Because we've had this happen at a time where the economy is depressed at a time where capital is on the sidelines, people are looking for jobs in very large numbers, this has been able to add in significant ways to overall employment. And the estimates that are out there put the numbers around 500,000 to 1 million jobs. I don't think that that's implausible. I think it's an aggressive estimate, but it's not implausible. I should add that a lot of the policies that have supported clean energy development over the last few years have also added to total jobs, again, because they are being pursued against the backdrop of a relatively weak economy.
Talking again, if you just joined us, with Michael Levy, the author of The Power Surge, Energy Opportunity and the Battle for America's Future. And I'm going to open the phone lines now because I want to talk also a little bit about the nuclear issues. Michael Levy with the Council on Foreign Relations is also an expert on armaments and nuclear arms and has talked with us before about that. But I want to give the opportunity for those of you listening to join this conversation, particularly about energy strategy. And, you know, do we have to choose between fossil fuels and green energy, or can we provide some kind of balance and, well, moderate, reasonable synthesis between the two and go forward? This is very polarized debate, obviously, and there are ideological lines, as I said, but you may want to weigh in one way or the other, or simply ask a question. And if you do, you can join us now at our toll-free number. Let me give it to you. It's 866-733-6786. We welcome your phone calls and your involvement in the program, so feel free to join us now at our toll-free number. It's 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum. Click on this segment. And, of course, you can also go to our Facebook page or tweet us. Our Twitter handle's @KQEDForum. I want to get your calls on here in just a moment, so feel free to join us. But I want to go first to, what happened in Berlin and the rhetoric in Berlin. Not even necessarily rhetoric. The president saying we should reduce nuclear armaments by a third. I want to talk with you, of course, about nuclear energy as well. Clean energy, as many people feel, with lots of nuclear waste. But the reality is that President Obama, for quite some time now, has been talking about reducing nuclear weapons. Now he's really in Berlin, appropriately enough, I suppose. Ich bin ein Berliner and all that, saying, look, we've got to do it and we're going to do it. And from your perspective, is this going to, first of all, be followed through upon and realized? And what kind of effect?
I hope he got himself a jelly donut while he was there. I think it's important that the president is continuing to talk about reducing our nuclear arsenals and using that as an incentive to others to reduce their nuclear arsenals. We have over 1,500 strategic nuclear weapons, more than enough to deter anyone from aggression against the United States. He's talking about cuts to around 1,000 nuclear weapons. I find it hard to imagine that leaders in Iran or North Korea will say, we're scared of the United States with 1,500 weapons, but if they only have 1,000, then maybe we should really go and try to be more aggressive. So I think we can reduce our risks. We can, over the long run, reduce our costs, and perhaps get a little more international support for our nonproliferation efforts if we are seen as still committed to nuclear disarmament.
And what about the president on climate change in Berlin?
The president has talked a good talk on climate change and has been able to pursue some important policies, particularly strong new rules for fuel economy on cars and trucks, aiming at 54.5 miles per gallon, loosely speaking, by 2025. He has been less successful in trying to enact economy-wide policy, in large part because he doesn't get to do that by himself. He has to have Congress pass policy. We had in 2008, not all that long ago, President Obama and Senator McCain fighting over whose cap-and-trade program was better. That was a very different political world when it came to pursuing climate strategy and climate policy. Today, we're a lot further away from being able to do that. I think it's important to be rebuilding the foundations for strong climate policy in the interim. I expect the president to be talking about Clean Air Act regulations for existing power plants, using existing laws to try and curb emissions. It's a challenging area. The Clean Air Act was not designed for this sort of goal. It's a set of tools that doesn't inherently provide as much flexibility as you would like, but I'm optimistic that regulators can find a creative way to use the existing rules to take advantage of our cheap natural gas that can substitute for coal and our fallen costs for alternative energy in order to further cut our emissions.
And let's talk about nuclear energy for just a moment, because many of the advocates will point out it's clean energy, and they talked about frequently, of course, bring up France and so forth. From your perspective, I mean, is there a middle ground, particularly when you're talking about the waste and well, all of the formidable problems that are we're confronted with is vis-a-vis nuclear waste.
Well, the most formidable problem we have for nuclear power in the United States right now
terrorism.
Is that it's expensive.
It's also terrorism. I thought you were going to say it. I'm sorry because, you
but
know,
there are a host of different things you can worry about, right? There's waste. There are attacks on power plants. There's local safety issues. But even if you were to resolve all of those perfectly, the reality would be that people don't want to build nuclear power plants because they're expensive. We've seen in the last year or two as plants come up even for safety upgrades. So not the full cost of building a new plant, but just the cost of doing the safety upgrades. Some of the operators are deciding that it's not worth doing that because they can't make money on the other side. They're better off shutting the plant down and operating a natural gas-fired power plant. In the long run, if we have strong policy on climate that penalizes sources that generate a lot of emissions, nuclear power will gain an advantage as a low-emission source. Then we'll have to make sure we are on top of the safety issues, the waste disposal issues, so that nuclear power can be something that's acceptable as one of several zero-carbon alternatives. One of my hopes is that perhaps now is a good time to be resolving some of those issues because it's not on the back of a large string of pending construction efforts. We're in a lull for nuclear power. Maybe we can have a slightly less charged effort to get our waste disposal policy right and to get some of these other pieces right.
I mentioned that Tom Friedman was on yesterday, and somehow Jeremy Rifkin came up because he was talking about jobs and all the jobs that have been replaced by technology. Rifkin was also a great advocate of hydrogen energy. I mean, he wrote a whole book on it, and he said, you know, this is definitely the way for our future. This is the way to go and so forth. What's happened?
Engineers love hydrogen energy. Hydrogen energy is extremely efficient. It's very sweet, as an engineer or scientist would call it. The problem we've had with hydrogen, aside from some basic technical challenges, is that we have a chicken and egg issue. If you want to build out, for example, a vehicle fleet that uses hydrogen, you need to get a lot of people to buy cars that use hydrogen fuel cells, and you need to get a lot of companies to build fueling stations that allow them to refill. Now, who's going to do which first?
Arnold Schwarzenegger was going to do that, as I recall.
Well, Arnold Schwarzenegger, I know he has a lot of cars, but I'm not sure if it's enough to support an entire network of filling stations.
When he was governor, he did talk a good deal about hydrogen stations and all the like. So, I mean, that presents, obviously, a kind of impossible impact.
I don't know that it's an impossible impact. If you talk to people at the car companies, they're still saying that 20 years down the road, they see a real shot for hydrogen. It's one of those ones where if you have a nucleus of efforts where people put together a series of filling stations in an area and maybe a fleet of trucks that uses them, you could see a demonstration effect. And this is a really important thing that happens in the energy world and in a lot of other worlds. People don't want to move until they've seen that something can be viable. They wait for someone else to show that it's viable. The problem is that if everyone waits for everyone else to show that something works, no one does it.
Well, you would think that with all the Priuses out there, you know, or electric cars and talks about different kinds of batteries, I mean, hasn't moved with quite the quantum speed that many people assumed it would move.
But we are seeing significant gains on the electric front, and in part because you don't need a new infrastructure network. We already have that network. It's the electric grid and people's outlets at home. And so we're seeing gains. The Prius was the number three selling car in the world last year.
Bigger gains expected and hoped for by many. Talking with Michael Levy, and he's Senior Fellow for Energy and Environment, Director of the Program on Energy Security and Climate Change with Council on Foreign Relations. You can join us at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or email us forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments onto our website, kqed.org/forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum, and Michael Levy is our guest. He heads the Program on Energy Security and Climate Change at the Council on Foreign Relations, talking about his new book, The Power Surge, Energy Opportunity and the Battle for America's Future, which investigates the growing energy revolutions in the United States. And by revolutions, I mean, of course, green energy revolution, and the revolution which means, at this point, more production of oil than we had perhaps imagined possible, and the numbers just continue to go up. He's speaking tonight at the World Affairs Council in San Francisco at 6:30 p.m., and you can join us on the program. And, of course, we welcome your calls, not only in terms of whether or not You think there's sense and not only reasonable logic to this position that Michael Levy has forged out for himself and for us as an energy strategy, that is a balance between the best of what so-called soft energy has to offer, or soft positions with respect to alternative energies, and the harder positions of fossil fuels and the nuclear, the harder lines of energy production. And what do you think the Obama administration's priorities ought to be with respect to energy policy? I mean, that gets right to the heart of what we're talking about here. And again, a number of ways to join us. Lines are full, but you can grab a line when it becomes available at 866-733-6786 or email us forum@kqed.org or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum, and our Facebook page is also available to you to place comments on. Let me get to our callers, and we begin with you, Keith. Hi, you're on.
Yeah, thanks, Michael. I really enjoy the show, and thank you, Mr. Levy, for talking to us about this energy policy. I had a question on the pipeline. As you know, the price of natural gas has impacted many industries in the U.S., most specifically freight rail, which had a huge business around moving coal. They've now done a great job of transitioning to moving oil by freight train, and of course they're able to move it end-to-end rather than through a pipeline, and rail is very economical, being able to move a ton of freight over 400 miles on a gallon of fuel. They're looking at switching to natural gas locomotives and other things. So I was just curious, you know, is there a need for the XL pipeline? Can't the rail industry handle what it proposes to do? And by the way, I'm not in the rail industry, but just a big fan. I'd love your comments.
Okay, and thank you for that, Keith. And, of course, it brings up Keystone, which we haven't even broached at this point. But Michael Levy.
I worry about too much oil transport moving to rail. Rail is inherently less safe than pipeline transport. If you have a derailment when you're transporting a lot of oil or bitumen in the case of what would be coming from Canada, and that creates significant risks. And you don't have rail regulated for its transport of oil products in the same way that you regulate pipelines, because pipelines are inherently about oil. The other thing I would say is that thinking about whether we need one approach versus another when it comes to transport, let's say, is the wrong way of going about things. I think we need to put the right rules in place. We need to have good safety standards, whether it's for rail or for pipelines. But then it's not really to the government to micromanage whether a particular piece of energy gets transported by a pipeline or by a rail system. Better to focus on getting the safety standards right and let the market do the rest. It's one of the things I emphasize in the book. Part of what has dragged us into these tough ideological fights over energy is that they're often proxies for fights over whether government should be deeply involved in the economy or not involved at all in the economy. And it seems to me that we ought to focus on the big things that government needs to do. The big environmental protection, the big efforts to cut our oil consumption, the big efforts to reduce emissions, but not wrap that up in a strategy where we are micromanaging decisions throughout the economy.
Have a listener who says, do you think, and again, we're talking about energy policy here, the investment tax credit for renewable energy that's set to expire in 2016 should be extended? And what else can the federal government do to encourage a conversion of vehicles to natural gas, compressed natural gas, in order to reduce our demand on oil?
So those are two very interesting questions. I do think that we need support for alternative energy development, partly research and development, partly to get the science right, but also for deployment. Including things like the investment tax credit. What we see is that as we put new sources of energy out there, we learn a lot about how to make them cheaper in ways that we wouldn't be able to do in the labs. So as you get more solar out, for example, we learn how to do financing that helps people buy these relatively expensive panels up front and then capture the savings that they get later. We learn how to do installation better in ways that save us money, because installation is a huge part of the cost of solar energy. It's not just the cost of the panels. You can go on and on. Now, you don't want to go too far. You don't want to spend money where you're not getting a payoff, and you have to look at each policy on its own basis. But as a general rule, there is an important role for government in promoting innovation here. On the natural gas vehicles front, and there's been a lot of talk about compressed natural gas vehicles, I see them as having significant disadvantages. First, you go only about a quarter as far in a tank because compressed natural gas isn't as dense as gasoline or diesel. On top of that, you have an issue with infrastructure. People have natural gas in their homes, but you would have to pay several thousand dollars to get a home filling station for a car, and we don't have a built-out system of filling stations for vehicles on the road. If I were looking for a place where natural gas will make big inroads in transportation, it's long-haul trucking and liquefying the gas and using it on a handful of set routes that are trafficked by big rigs, where individual companies or small groups of them can get together and build out the infrastructure in order to take advantage of the low natural gas prices we're facing.
We go to another of our callers. Chris, you're on. Good morning.
Thank you for taking my question. Mr. Levy, could you please address the policy issue of subsidies for fossil fuels versus subsidies for alternative energies? I've seen several studies that claim that fossil fuels, in fact, receive far more subsidies than alternative fuels. However, that's a very mature market and proven science.
A lot depends on how you do the numbers. What I would say is that we have a series of tax benefits that fossil fuel production gets. That includes something called the percentage depletion allowance that basically pays you a certain amount of money for every unit of oil you produce. We have something else called the manufacturing. It's a manufacturing tax credit that you get for oil production. These are tax treatments that cost the government money, do not appear to stimulate much additional oil production, but do add to companies' bottom lines. I don't see them as having a meaningful role in our future energy strategy. I think that we should either be removing them or redeploying the money to places that will actually enhance technology development or enhance oil production in meaningful ways that help the economy or national security. But taking money, spending it on things that don't even have any payoff seems to me to be the worst of all worlds.
And Chris, thank you for that question. I think it almost goes without saying, but I'll say it anyway, that there have been enormously inflated expectations where alternative energy is concerned, and that's part of our problem. I mean, I'm not talking about Solyndra here or anything. I'm just talking about jobs and supposedly all the transition that could presumably be brought into fruition.
We're looking at big changes to our energy system if we want to tackle our problems, and that means sustained support over not just months and years but decades for boosting zero carbon energy and more efficient sources. And overselling what we can get in the short run, whether it's on jobs or economic growth, I think might give you a sugar high when it comes to political support, but it doesn't get you that sustained backing that you're going to need over the long haul. So I do worry that we have oversold the near-term jobs benefits of moving to different energy sources. And I do think we've oversold the competitiveness gains. I would hope that we could sell these kinds of technologies on the fact that they help us deal with big challenges that this country faces and that the world faces. We need to reduce emissions. We need to become less dependent on oil consumption. That should be very good reason to be pursuing those technologies. I would rather sell those technologies on things they can deliver than on things that they're less likely to.
But, you know, when you cut to the chase here, a lot of this battle of these two sides, I mean, it's not only ideological, as you suggested, big government, small government. It's really, you know, who's profiting. I mean, the big oil industries obviously have tremendous lobbying weight in up on the Hill and in every branch of government, really. Perhaps not as much as the judiciary, but certainly in the legislative and the executive. And the reality is that alternative energy is gaining in strength in terms of its lobbying force. I mean, Sierra Club is just as powerful almost as many of the other biggest lobbies. But the fact of the matter is money and politics can't be separated. Where energy is concerned, they cannot be separated.
Politics is politics. And if you want to get to a point where it's not purely a zero-sum game, the different sides have to see benefits from making some compromises rather than identifying things that hurt their traditional opponents with things that benefit themselves. So let me give you one example. If the natural gas industry and the nuclear power world and people who support renewables got together, they should be able to agree that pricing carbon in one way or another would boost all of their fortunes, at least in the near to medium term, because they would all gain against coal. Now, politically, they should all be able to benefit by supporting that sort of strategy. Instead, what we tend to see is that the nuclear guys see that gas will win and the renewable guys see that nuclear might win. And they all say, well, if the other guy is going to do better off this, then I'm not interested in it.
Let's bring in more of our calls. Our guest again is Michael Levy, and our next caller is John Halls. Good morning.
Good morning. Very interesting program. Thank you very much. One of the things that I was involved with at Dominican University with some modeling on energy use in the environment, and one of the things that's striking is that the Scandinavian countries and Germany have well-defined policies for using natural gas as a bridge fuel to renewables. And we don't hear anything about that in the United States. And there's some pretty compelling examples in the Scandinavian countries, like the island of Samsø, which has an integrated farm, tourist, and residential community, is now 100% energy independent. There's several cities that have combined methane production, biomass, and centralized heating to the point that they're energy neutral. We don't see much of that in the United States, so I'd be interested in knowing why you think that is so.
It's difficult to make very large transformations at the scale of a country like the United States. It's much easier to make them on smaller scales. For example, if you are Denmark and you use a lot of wind generation, you can still import electricity from other countries when the wind isn't blowing. The United States as a whole doesn't have nearly the same sort of ability to fill in from other places. I do think we can see experiments across the United States, and we are seeing experiments across the United States.
Excuse me, Mike. I was just looking at a listener's tweet that says, offshore wind energy in the new energy economy, we could build large farms off New York City or Boston.
We could. Offshore wind energy is very expensive. And again, by deploying it, we can gain experience and bring costs down. But I wouldn't want to go too fast. You would push people's rates up in ways that aren't justified by the technology gains that you have. Again, this gets back to the caller's question about a bridge fuel. Natural gas can help us reduce emissions, make sure we're not building new coal-fired power plants that will be around for half a century. But in order for it to be an actual bridge, we need the strategies to create the other side of the bridge, to have the technologies available in order to cut our emissions even further, and then to make sure people adopt those.
Let me thank the caller and getting some requests for your opinion about an alternative nuclear energy, thorium, with the molten salt reactors. And in fact, there's, I think, a caller on the line on that. John, good morning.
Good morning. I'd like to just ask a question with regards to thorium molten salt reactors. We developed those back in the 1960s. We did. We had test reactors, and then we stopped using that technology because it didn't produce any reference grade plutonium, etc. Now that the Chinese and the Indians are basically working on developing that technology for their own use to create electricity, wouldn't it behoove the United States to throw some investment dollars either through the government or through the private sector to develop that technology so that we can then create a more sustainable energy future?
So there are private investors, as I understand it, in the United States looking at thorium. Thorium has been on the horizon for a very long time, and it continues to be on the horizon. What I see from U.S. government investment in nuclear energy is a real focus on what are called small modular reactors. So reactors that aren't only in these huge chunks, but in smaller pieces, and that could be standardized in their construction. And what that goes after is the fact that one of the big costs for nuclear power is the cost of financing construction. You have a lot of uncertainty. It takes a long time to build. These are very expensive. So you pay an enormous amount of interest on top of the cost of building the reactor. By moving to these smaller ones, in principle, you might be able to reduce those financing costs and bring down nuclear power costs. So that seems to be where the U.S. government is focusing. You see private investment in thorium. But again, I haven't heard people make the case for a pathway to costs that are so low that nuclear power would be able to emerge in a very strong way in this country without some kind of effort to level the playing field on emissions.
And I thank the caller. And go to another call. Let me go to David, who joins us from Fairfax. David, hi.
Hi, good morning. My question is about fuel cell systems, standalone fuel cell systems. I'm just wondering if you could comment on, I know that companies like Google and Walmart are experimenting with them as energy sources as they are not on the grid. And if you could comment about where you see those coming into play.
So I won't predict the future on fuel cell systems, but what I will say is that they're part of a broader class of solutions that are extraordinarily important, and that's storage. We haven't really talked about storage. But if you're using renewable energy, wind energy that doesn't always come because the wind doesn't always blow, or solar energy, again, because the sun doesn't always shine, you want to be able to store power when it's produced or energy when it's produced and use it as power when you need it. And whether it's fuel cells or another technology that allows you to do that storage, that could really transform the economic prospects for renewable energy. Other storage tools could also make big impacts for cars and trucks. So I'm happy to see different companies experimenting with these. If one of them has significant success, I imagine that others will follow.
And I thank the caller. Let me go to some of your emails. Carl wants to know where conservation fits into this diversified portfolio of yours.
Conservation and efficiency are hugely important. And we're seeing substantial gains in cars and trucks in particular. We've had we've had strong increases in the efficiency of our cars and trucks over the last several years, spurred by high prices and by improving technologies. And I think we're going to see even bigger gains in the year ahead, in the years ahead. The other place where we see interesting gains in efficiency is in buildings. And buildings represent a huge piece of our energy use and of our emissions. And whether it's light bulbs or whether it's insulation or whether it's our appliances, there are a host of different places where we can cut down on our emissions. Sometimes that will come from price-based incentives. Sometimes it will have to come from regulations that prescribe particular ways to reduce emissions in our buildings. Just about 2 weeks ago, the Department of Energy issued new rules for microwaves. Sounds really mundane, but these little pieces can add up in a big way and help consumers save money while delivering on some of our national goals. So efficiency and conservation, very important in pursuing our objectives.
Let me read some more responses we're getting. Well, here's one on thorium. Last year, the World Affairs Council hosted an advocate for thorium-based reactors as much more clean and efficient than uranium, but his refusal to address the inherent disadvantages of the source left him looking like a snake oil salesman. And then on the Keystone, Kari's tweets, Keystone Pipeline moving oil over the most sensitive water source in the nation, the Ogallala Aquifer, it's insane. Look to the Arkansas spill. Another listener, Orion, writes, please also consider our costs on wars to keep the pipeline from OPEC open. It's getting a lot of opinions here and some questions. Rachel writes, how do you see renewable energy affected by lobbying, which represents more entrenched energy policies, and how can we support development of alternative energy effectively versus very powerful invested interests when to make switches requires many stars to align?
A lot of interesting points there. Let's talk about alternative energy. One of the things that makes it more feasible to get support in Washington for alternative energy is the actual deployment of renewable energy sources. As people see these operating in their communities, as they see jobs in their communities, I think you build out support for more aggressive policy. I do think that trying to broaden the tent of people who would be in favor of the deployment of new energy sources and support for the deployment of new energy sources is extremely important. So while there are tensions with traditional interests, there are also places to build common ground. I think of the U.S. Climate Action Partnership that combine environmental groups and companies making clean energy technology and pieces of the oil industry in 2006, 7, 8, 9 around cap and trade legislation that would have benefited all of them if done right. To me, that's a very important piece
of the equation. But which was not done right because?
We had more than enough reasons why cap and trade didn't come through. This was a strategy based on the fact that people were supposed to like something because it was market-based. Cap and trade was a market-based system. Then when the economy crashed, market-based became a four-letter word. On top of that, you had intense political polarization.
I was going to say, again, it's just economy. A lot of politics.
A lot of politics, absolutely. And look, you're not going to ram energy strategy, no matter how smart it is, through a totally poisonous political environment. But what you do need is to have some common sense tools and a smart way of doing things so that if the political circumstances turn, you can take advantage of that.
Listener writes, regarding nuclear waste, there is 50,000 tons of waste at the 102 reactors in the United States. Given that the current technology is highly inefficient, creates a lot of waste, extremely expensive, and potentially dangerous, shouldn't the U.S. invest in thorium reactors that don't create waste, don't need expensive containment vessels, and have already been done back in the 60s? The Chinese and the Indians are working on this technology. Shouldn't we be a leader in a technology that we originally created? It keeps coming up, doesn't it?
Thorium keeps coming up, and I'll say I agree with either it was a caller or a writer who said that people who advocate thorium for nuclear power spend a little too much time talking about the upsides and not enough time being frank about some of the limitations. One of the limitations, and this comes up over and over in our efforts to think about waste and how we deal with it, is that if you have technologies that the technologies that tend not to produce waste are ones that tend to be more proliferation prone. So if the technologies were to spread around the world, it would be easier to divert the products for producing nuclear weapons. And I've been torn on this for a long time. I think that proliferation resistance is not just a technical quality. It's something where you need to set up the right politics, the right governance to make sure that countries can't exploit nuclear power to produce nuclear weapons. But I think we ought to be very careful before we get too excited about one particular way of producing nuclear energy to make sure that we are not, while tackling climate change by reducing emissions, creating a big nuclear proliferation problem for ourselves.
This goes against the principle of emphasis on the upsides rather than the downsides, doesn't it?
That I argue in the book and that I will argue consistently is that there are things that have downsides that are too strong and that we shouldn't be pursuing. So it's not a blind focus on the upsides.
Thorium being one of those.
Thorium being something that I'm ambivalent about and I would love to understand better, and I would love to have people who are promoting thorium help all of us understand it a bit better.
That is a challenge to those of you who have been all these many years advocating thorium whenever we touch on energy subjects. Let me go to another caller in the meantime. Van, thanks for waiting. Hi.
Thank you for taking the call. I'd like to ask Michael Luby his perspective on waste to energy. It seems like environmental groups are, you know, against traditional incineration, but they're not looking differently at newer conversion technologies, and they also seem to be ideologically adamant about recycling to the point where we're not taking advantage of these technologies, and we continue to move, you know, thousands of tons to landfills on a daily basis. I'll take my comments off the air.
Okay, thank you for the call.
So waste to energy is very interesting, and the caller's right that you see technological development that allows you to do it in a cleaner way. But this speaks to a broader tension. It's a tension between tools that would help us reduce our energy demand and maybe cut our emissions and the local impacts that even those technologies have. It's not just oil and gas that has challenging local impacts. It's also alternative energy technologies. When I was writing the book, I had a discussion in it of some of the opposition to wind farms. And everyone who I handed the draft to said, well, this is implausible. People who want to cut emissions love wind farms, period. I said, well, I didn't find it implausible because I spoke to a lot of those people. And you see this over and over, and the caller points to another example in waste to energy. We need to figure out a good balance between respecting local concerns, because ultimately people have to live with these energy developments, and tackling our big national goals, which requires a wholesale transformation in the American energy system.
And global concerns as well. I mean, you can't separate those.
Oh, certainly. And when I say our national concerns, one of those national concerns is dealing with global climate change. Another is keeping world oil consumption down so that we can have lower prices and more resilience in the market.
Interesting question from a listener named James. He says, is it worth speaking about the history of oil production? Why were we producing so little 20 years ago? And what circumstances created this big surge in production? And why weren't the new technologies seen by the industry back then? Or were there larger political influences holding down production?
It's a great question. The biggest thing holding down production 20 years ago was rock bottom prices. And we've seen in the last decade a skyrocketing of prices. And it's important to keep that in mind because the developments we've had are not all upside. In order to get these big gains in supply, we've had to suffer some pretty big price increases. We would probably be better off with lower prices and the lower production that would come from that. What happened in the last decade or so was that sustained high prices create a lot of headroom for innovators. They were able to experiment with new technologies that hadn't made sense at lower prices, but that started to look attractive, and particularly this combination of horizontal drilling and hydraulic fracturing that's been applied to shale gas and tight oil. It happened in particular when natural gas prices were sky high, and over time, during that period of high prices, companies improved the technology. So when prices came down, they were still able to continue producing because the technology had gotten a lot better. So that's the basic trend line we've seen. One of the interesting lessons from this to me is that you can imagine applying this in other energy areas too. If you give companies and inventors a bit of headroom, an ability to sell into a market for a sustained period, whether it's alternative energy or more efficient cars and trucks, they can bring costs down to a point where you have new and more viable options.
Let's get another caller on. Peter, that's you. Hi.
Hi, Michael. How are you?
Okay, thank you.
I have a few quick comments here about China and India. You know, I'm a huge fan of, you know, the U.S. technology here in the United States, especially what's going to live more lives. But just because that India, you know, they purchase a few solar panels doesn't necessarily mean that they're pulling away in the green tech movement.
The caller is absolutely right. One of the things I've done over the last several years is traveled not only to India, but to China and to Brazil also to understand how they're pursuing alternative energy technologies. And we still have a strong technological edge. We're still innovating.
We don't even know where our technology is going to go. I mean, it's constantly pioneering in different ways that are unpredictable.
I think that's absolutely right. In a lot of cases, we find synergies with these other countries. So with China, inexpensive Chinese manufacturing of solar panels creates a market for ultra-pure silicon produced in the United States because they use it to make those panels. And then those less expensive panels come back here and make it easier to create a market for installing them on American homes. So there are these complicated interplays. And you see them, again, not just in clean energy, but in oil and gas. At this point, we're seeing a lot of demand from around the world for U.S. technologies that have enabled oil and gas production here to be applied elsewhere. So I think the caller is absolutely right. It's really easy to say we're about to get crushed by China and India. It's a nice slogan. I don't think that it lines up too well with reality.
Michael Levy, good to have you back on Forum. Thank you for joining us. Again, you can meet him tonight. He'll be at the World Affairs Council in San Francisco at 6:30. His book is, again, called The Power Surge, Energy Opportunity and the Battle for America's Future. And thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Michael.
And Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Gucci and Tina Larberg. Our engineer today is Howard Gelman. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai with online support from David Marks. Senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our interns are Keelan Cronin, Kelsey Dayton, Maddie Pelton, Jonathan Tam, and Evelyn Wang. And our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I remind you, you can continue this discussion simply by going on to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. And for all of us here at KQED Public Radio, thank you for being with us. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.